using this kind of metrics that the return of capital that we use internally is exactly aligned with our analysis of the risk on the one hand and the capital requirements that we have from the regulation on the other hand. A bit in a similar way, we all, I'm sure, use combined ratios, combined operational ratios to steer our P&C businesses especially. We know all the advantage of these kind of metrics. Once we have developed an internal model, we can develop what in our company we call economic combined ratio. I'm sure most other insurers have the same kind of concept, which also embed the cost of capital in the metric. And exactly as I said previously, does that in a manner that ensures a full alignment and the full consistency between the business considerations on the one hand and the capital on the other, the requirements on the other hand. Moving on to a slightly wider concept, again, I'm sure it's something common in all members of the CRO forum and also in many of the companies that are represented today. We of course develop and use a strong risk appetite framework. Here again, in the way we implement this risk appetite framework, we consider it's a real advantage to have an internal model that allows us to have a very thin analysis of, for instance, what is the measurement of one in 20 years event on a given risk or on a financial shock or on any insurance shock. If we want to set our risk appetite at the level of the one in 20 years, we have the measurement. If we want to set it at one in 50 or one in 100 years, we have the measurement. And not only it allows us to use the tool, but even more important, it is the starting point of a very rich discussion within the company between typically the risk management people and the business people and the CEOs of our various operations. Moving on again to slightly wider concept beyond the risk appetite, what I said is also valid, I would say, for the entire risk analysis. Two very important examples of the way we use this ability to fully analyze our risk using the internal model and that are worth being mentioned are first the way we set and design our reinsurance structure. Clearly, all groups that have those internal models have the ability to have very precise both analysis and discussions with their reinsurers or with their ceding companies for sure, for the reinsurers on the other hand, based on those measurements. And again, having the access to that detailed information and doing that in a world which is always consistent with the formal capital requirements is something we believe is a key advantage for the company. And last example on different topic, but of a similar nature, is also the asset allocation or more generally speaking, most of our ILM asset liability management studies, decisions, we can make them take into account the capital volatility that we measure with our internal model. Moving to the right hand of the slide, to complement that more with the what we believe to be the regulators and supervisors' view, and why we believe it is also to the benefit of the supervisors. The first thing to say, maybe for, I think Bernard already mentioned it, but for the evidence of top, what we discuss is primarily internal models aiming at capturing a measurement of the capital requirements. That means two things. The first thing is that the internal models we discuss here are based on the value of the portfolio of the company, which is exactly similar in the regulatory environment in which we operate to the ones that are used by the companies that are under standard model or formula. And I think that's an important point for the evidence of DOT. Therefore, it means that many insurers and many jurisdictions already do kind of internal model. As such, most of the regulatory balance sheets that we use are already built on kind of models. On top of that, an environment like the European one allows for determination of specific parameters as part of the standard formula. Next step, the calculation of a particular risk module or type within the standard formula. All these are examples of ways to already use internal models. And I think the message behind is just that we are in an industry, given the nature of our risk, where it's something one can almost not avoid to at some point use internal models. What we want to highlight is why we believe it's important, at least for some companies, typically the largest ones and all the most diversified ones, to have the ability to go up to using full internal models. And one word to say that a requirement for giving the possibility in a given regulatory framework to use full internal models is that there are important prerequisites, and all of our companies that have gone through that process of having validated internal models know what it means to have to develop a strong validation framework, a strong model change policy, a strong data quality policy and framework. Those three areas are at least the pillar of what makes what is necessary to as a counterpart to using internal model. And we fully acknowledge that it's the role of supervisors to set clear rules and requirements for that, and the role of companies that would like to use internal models to strictly apply those aspects. Once this is implemented, then that's where we believe it's also to the benefit of the supervisors. Why? Just because going through all this process of approving the model, of discussing the validation criteria, having the governance in place for all the future model changes once the model is implemented is something that makes mandatory a very detailed and specific discussion with the regulators or the supervisors and enriches very significantly the quality of those discussions. One typical example is that whenever the company would do an M&A deal or any kind of significant restructuring of its mix of business, This changes the risk profile of the company, and this, by construction, is the starting point to a detailed discussion with the regulator that ultimately has to approve the changes that have to be put forward to the model. I think that's most of what I wanted to present to you on this slide. I'm pleased to hand over to Fabrice.
Merci, Edouard. So I'll talk about challenges and limitations, and you will see that in the paper we address seven limitations when comparing the internal model to a standard approach. And I wanted to thank my colleague Marty Hansen from AIG Group, who was part of the working group of the CRO forum that wrote that section. And I think the fact that we consider seven potential limitations is sort of a testament to the fact that internal models make boards and management more inquisitive about their risk. And when I look at within my own company, we go through a lot of validation. We're talking about top-down validation for the board. We're talking about bottom-up validation, which is very, very technical. We're talking about discussion with the board, the management, and I think that's one of the main benefits of the internal model is this discussion about risk that happens within the companies that that do have them. So in this section, I'll be focusing not on the seven limitation, but that might be a bit too long, but we sort of group them into three different topics, which are comparability, model drift, and pro-cyclicality. So starting with comparability, I think one of the main limitations we see with the standard approach is that it may bucket different risk in the same category. And it sort of gives the illusion of comparability that two companies are alike, where in fact when you sort of scratch a little bit under the surface, you realize that what you've bucketed in the same group is in fact quite different. And that goes hand in hand with some of the things that Grégoire was just talking about in terms of the safeguards that we recognize need to be employed when you have internal models. And here we're talking about common principles, we're talking about standards, calibration standard, validation standard, and essentially the supervisory review and having supervisors that are well equipped to challenge the companies. We recognize this part of the whole sort of ecosystem that you need to have when internal models are used by a company. And I think fundamentally it's also about a philosophical viewpoint about comparability of outcomes versus comparability of inputs. And we would argue, especially within the CRO forum, that what's important is comparability of outcome so that we've got homogeneous standards of policyholder protection. So I move on to this question of potential model drift, and I guess you know there might be a suspicion that initially internal model might be under-calibrated, or that over time there can be a drift of internal model. I mean, we can tell, I think, as all the members of the CRO forum, that developing an internal model is quite a significant undertaking. We all have scars to show for that. And when I look at my own firm, you know, we spent 7 years developing an internal model for the European subsidiary, and some of the fellow members of the CRO forum have been working on the model since the mid-90s. So this is no mean undertaking. And why it's taking so long, I think, is provides reassurance. And it's not so much the technical challenges, but it's really due to the high standards that come with internal models. So we're talking here about governance of the companies. We're talking about the data requirement. The trilogy of data criteria sort of comes to mind when we mention that. But also the validation that is done internally, and I think the thoroughness of the regulatory approach and the review that has taken place. I think also it's not a once and done approach when you've got an internal model, so there's ongoing submission of logs of changes to regulators, and indeed I think most of our firms within the CRO forum go through a cycle of major model changes, and this is quite a demanding task, and indeed some regulators have sort of limited the number of changes you can do because this is such an onerous process both on firms and competent authorities themselves. I touched on the first slide on the involvement of the board, and I think, again, if I sort of look closer to home in the UK, it's something that's been quite significant. I don't think you would have the equivalent with a standard approach, and particularly we've had a system of use test interviews to show that management really understand how the internal model works. I mean, maybe not in the most sort of detailed level, but they've got a sufficient understanding for the strategic decisions that need to be made, like Gregoire was referencing a minute ago. And I think more importantly, when you look at the capital that is deployed within the insurance industry, there is absolutely no evidence of a reduction in the capital since Solvency II has been implemented. So I think that's a question of model rates, or sort of are we going to undercook the figures if you're compared to a standard approach, is one that empirically we can sort of refute. Procyclicality, I think, is a big issue that we need to consider in this debate. It's an issue for financial stability. It's an issue for policyholders, ultimately, and definitely an issue for regulators. I think when companies develop an internal model, the fact that each of them will have a slightly different approach, I'd say, and trying to achieve a common outcome, a slightly different ways of getting there, that introduces diversity in the system. And I think that's really a good thing for the industry generally. And Gregoire was going through the different uses of the model, and I think the fact that these models are not only used for regulatory purposes, but also to manage the business through reinsurance, through investment allocation, product mix, optimization, M&A, and so on. That means that it's a better approach than a standard approach. Well, in a standard approach, I think there might be the temptation to sort of optimize against that standard approach and a bit of herding behaviors, which I think, you know, by itself creates a systemic risk. And I think that's one of the potential dangers of having a standard approach. Again, taking the example of the UK, we have got the ICAS regime that was in place prior to Solvency II, and in a way, it's a bit of a precursor to Solvency II. I would say Solvency II is an evolution, effectively, of the ICAS regime. And again, looking at the track record of the ICAS, it performed quite well through the financial crisis when Solvency II was being developed. And I think we can take some comfort about the robustness of this model through a period of turmoil. If I try for a minute to put myself in the shoes of a regulator, you know, I would think about the failures of insurance companies, and particularly for the market I know, which is the UK market. And I look at the big failures we've had in recent years. I think on the non-life side of independent insurance, I think of Equitable Life on the life side. And I think you can quite easily build an argument that I'm not sure these companies would have failed, would have avoided failure if they had an internal model, but I'm certainly certain that they would have been much better equipped to deal with the flaws, effectively, of their business models if they had an internal model than the standard formula. And I think, again, looking at the track record of the regime, that is important. Internal model, and again, the ecosystem that comes with them in terms of governance, in terms of uses, in terms of believing what you do from the inside of the company rather than seeing it as something that is sort of artificially imposed from the outside. So there were the remarks I had about the challenges and the limitations of the model, and I'll now hand it over to Bernhard to conclude.
So, conclusion, very short to also leave room for questions and discussion. We very much appreciate the role that internal models now have in the ICS framework going forward, but we would like also to have internal models really as leading metric in the ICS for those companies who can proof that they really have all the necessary preconditions to run internal models in place. And of course, we are very happy to support this process. We are very happy also to give our expertise, our insight, and also, of course, to have any discussion in every country, every continent, where there have to be, of course, also a better understanding on those sides that have not the history, have not gone through this process, and perhaps have some more reluctancy, of course, to buy into such an approach. With this, thank you so much. And want to open for questions.
Yeah. Any questions from the floor? From the desk? There's one from the desk. This is a more general question, and it relates to something that's coming up later in our stakeholder meeting about ICS is part of Comframe, and Comframe has within it the ERM and more particularly ORSA requirements. As per the consultation we've put out as a requirement for all IIGs to have an economic capital model and provide their own view of their solvency. How do you see that relating to internal models for regulatory requirements? And you would have some experience of that in the European context as well. So I wonder if you could speak to that as to how this fits with an overall supervision framework.
Yeah. I think you're pointing already to a discussion, especially in the ORSA context, where you, as a company, but also as a supervisor, have to deal with the questions in any case, because to reflect on, is my risk profile adequately captured by, for example, a standard approach or a regulatory metric that is currently in place, and to see and analyze where this does not fit and what does it mean for us or for the company and what do I have to do with this, should be exactly the dialogue about where do I have to dig deeper and where do I simply have to also use internal modeling, internal data, internal intelligence to also show that there is an issue, there is no issue. And so in the dialogue that you are referencing to, I also share this, that this is already going in this direction. And if you would start with ORSA and would take this discussion serious and push every year further, I think after 5 years you would also end up with the companies having all the internal modeling done to capture their risk profile in an adequate way.
For me, it's a bit in the name already. You know, we're talking about ORSA. I think the O stands for own, so it's really a bit difficult for the standard approach and make it your own. And when you look at, so within the company, we have some parts are on the standard formula of solvency too, some parts are on internal model, but certainly we find that as the businesses become more complex, either we sort of spend our time looking at the limitation of the standard formula and then trying to address them with USP and all the different mechanisms, but we sort of pushed in a way when the business becomes more complex to have an internal model, because you're sort of trying to adjust something that doesn't quite fit as the company becomes bigger and more complex. So the ORSA is sort of, if you start with the standard approach, it becomes a long dissertation about why it's not appropriate and how you sort of addressing the limitations of it.
You get also the lots of trade-offs there, effectively, when you got calls yesterday, for example, we would like to deal with internal ratings. We would like to deal with risk mitigation, especially for variable annuities like dynamic aging, and that, other type of issues. And you realize when you're building a framework that effectively certain things are particular to specific type of firms, and certain firms, because they have specific risk profile, they will need a certain tailoring of the capital requirement to fit better the risk profile. Whereas if we were trying to build a standard method, we try to cater for every single possibility there, there will be lots of parts, a lot of calculation, which will be entirely burdensome for some of the firms for little or no value. And this is why the trade-off there between risk sensitivity for everybody but not with much advantage and, you know, complexity of calculation and so on. So I think that actually a certain thing, you know, the standard method will take you to a certain level, but there are some nuances there which will be able to capture them.
So I'll build off of Peter's question for a second, and I mean this, tend this more kind of as a constructive criticism question of the issue, and I'd be curious for your views as you talk about looking to the IAS to set standards on principles and validation procedures. There seems a tension between, even though it's no longer a standard approach, there are some standardized assumptions, methodologies to start getting baked into that require some kind of approval process. And certainly one of the values of internal models is this tailoring, and I have unique risks. And that to me is going to be the real meat of it, is where you find that balance, because I could easily see companies feeling constrained that, well, we have an improved internal model, but we need to change it, and how do we go about that process? I'm just curious if you've thought much down that road.
Mm. So I absolutely agree that, especially for huge international insurance groups or reinsurance groups, you simply have to dig deeper. And also that means a lot of effort from industry side, but also from supervisory and also regulatory side. And the approach that we took now until we got our internal models approved under the Solvency II regime took us many, many, many years. And exactly these kind of starting point on a principle-based view and approach, and then see where really more detailed guidance is necessary, without really going into deep rule-based, so this is exactly the validation procedure that you have to follow, but simply to have quality standards defined for validation that are essential, that also make you adjust the models if it's necessary from an economic perspective. These are the things you really have to develop going the way. And you're absolutely right. This is essential. That also, I think, is the benefit, if you would ask me of the benefit of going through this internal model approval process. It was really about exactly these kind of transparency, validation kind of exercises, even though it was painful, but also for us, there was insight that we got out of it. But again, very difficult to define beforehand, but really something to be developed on the way.
Tom Gibbons, Pacific Life, thanks for the presentation. To Paulo's point about managing standardization with kind of idiosyncratic approaches to measurement, I would just add the comment that when it comes to models, probably most important to consider them in the context of insurance risk, because that's where most of the kind of idiosyncratic measurement gets very involved.
Just maybe one comment on those tensions between the standardization and the refinements and of the risk measurement. That's where we believe it's important that a framework as early as possible, like ICS, as early as possible in its development, embeds the notion that in our view, there is the possibility of a kind of continuum between ranging from the pure use of standard methodologies up to the full the full internal models, and if the standard has been developed, integrating that again as early as possible in its development. We believe really, because that's more or less our experience, that the rules can be done such that there is overall a consistency in the output of the model. It's just a matter of having different degrees in the detail in which we go.
I certainly wouldn't want to come across as sort of an internal model sort of fundamentalist. I think it depends on the size of the company, it depends on the complexity of its structure, and certainly for me there's a big role to be played by the regulator. Think in terms of benchmarking. So as companies we use benchmarking via consultants, but I think the best benchmarking, obviously the full view of the market comes through the regulator, who's very well placed to see whether there's a huge discrepancy in the way companies assess their own risk, which for me would be an indication that this is not something that's going to be well captured by a standard approach, because it means that the underlying nature of the risk is quite different. I think you're right that in some cases companies might say, well, it's not really worth it in a way, because we believe that the standard approach is good enough in a way, and it's certainly onerous to also maintain an internal model on both the company side and the regulatory side. So that's why partially internal model, I think I've got a role to play, and there are certainly, but here we're talking about I think in the context of the ISS, really larger companies, complex company where this is more suited.
And perhaps one additional remark. In the starting phase of Solvency II, I think after 1 year, we also gave up trying to get all the details of the reinsurance business into the standard formula of Solvency II, because there was no way. And if you look at our natural catastrophe models, you don't want to start thinking about standardizing them. Anyway, so there was a deliberate decision to say, okay, reinsurers are applying for internal models anyway, so we can leave them out. But then it's again about what you really are targeting, what kind of insurance business or companies, and what is then, again, the way in between how detailed it has to be and how standardized it can be.
Yes, please.
Yeah, thank you. Representing a group using standard formula approach under Solvency II, I thought I would take the opportunity to make some comments and say that there are interesting approaches with internal models, and we think we should be respectful of the work that's done when trying to assess specifically risks and, you know, more accurately, but we can see drawbacks as well and all kind of risks there, idiosyncratic risks, and this is where, well, I think we need to be respectful of all approaches, standard formula, and the other end of the spectrum, the internal models, but then we need reassurance that these models are well supervised. That is absolutely key. And then if it's so, but this is costly for both the insurance and the supervisors. By the way, we have significant reinsurance in our group and quite sophisticated sometimes, and still we find a way to express that in the standard formula, because we have those three insurance guidelines. Now, what I wanted to say is that also what I think is a good thing about internal models is that there is maybe a better link with, a real life and going concern approach, which is sometimes unfortunately missing in the prudential supervision. Prudential capital standards, they say they are on the going concern basis, but unfortunately not fully, and often, there is some artificial limit drawn with going concern, and the internal models, this is where they can bring I think, some value helping to link with, yes, Pillar 2, real risk management, and help the undertakings manage, in a relevant way, not as if they were going to close tomorrow. That's something we think the prudential approach is sometimes forgetting.
Thanks. Any more questions, observations? I think Lutz, it's your turn. Also, you have to move by 4 somewhere else as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Very green.
Very green, yeah. Okay, I think I can start. So thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you very much for listening to me. My name is Lutz Wilhelmi. I'm here on behalf of Swiss Re and the Swiss Actuarial Association. I would like to talk about valuing insurance liabilities and just in a more narrow setting than has been spelled out before, just like under the market adjusted valuation with a cost of holding capital margin over current estimate. But before I want to go into that, let me say that I'm very pleased and pleasured that I'm talking just after Bernard, Grégoire, and Fabrice, and we subscribe to every single syllable that was said before. But let me go inside this. What I want to talk about is that under certain circumstances, certain conditions that I will spell out, some of what we have done in the last two or three years is actually a little bit obsolete. And that is the question of taking the asset spread or part of the asset spread into account when discounting insurance liabilities. So this is a pretty bold statement, and so I put it in the form of a mathematical theorem, and the rest of my talk will be essentially about the proof of it. So I'm exposing it. We will also put it into a paper so that you can have a look at it. It's a disappointing fact. It is a very disappointing fact for me because, as some of you might know, we have been part of the Own Assets with Guardrails group in the beginning, one of the founding members. When we tried to get our act together, we had to pull out like a year ago when concerns were coming up that we're missing something. And it took us about a year to get like a little bit safe about the facts. So the preconditions are there. If we take market-adjusted valuation, and I'll just repeat what has been said before, market-adjusted valuation is to produce insurance liability by matching fixed income instruments. So not necessarily risk-free, but any kind of matching fixed income instruments that match in expectation the cash flows of the liabilities. And from that you derive the interest rate. So this is how interest rates are derived, also the one in the ICS is derived like that in Solvency II in every system. And then you leave some risk on the table, the one that the insurance risk essentially deviates from the expected, so that the real insurance cash flows deviating from the expected cash flows. And for that, you hold capital. You not only hold it like for 1 year, but you hold it over the lifetime of the liabilities in each of the runoff years, the respective amount of capital that you need to hold. And who provides that capital? An investor. And what does he ask for? He asks for a return. So the cost of holding capital, MOCI, is the discounted returns that we have to provide to the investor in order that he provides the risk capital that makes the runoff of the insurance liability so safe that it is bearable for the policyholders. And by the way, that answers also, Avitex, your question. It's a feature, right? It's a feature of the MOCI that it's sufficient for the runoff in the own company or to the transfer to a different company. So, and secondly, and that's perhaps the precondition that can be debated, an investor is asking market returns for credit default risks. And to be honest, I mean, I know working for a reinsurer, we are also sometimes asked to take on credit default risk without any return for it. We usually refuse that. But obviously, there are investors out there that take default risk at a lower price, like private investors. But working for a company that is publicly listed, our experience is investors in the capital market ask the market price for default risk. But that can be debated. Then, so if you take these two or three assumptions, then the value of the liabilities is minimal if you discount them by risk-free rates. And that also means that the available capital is maximal, so you optimize company value if you are using risk-free rates. And it also means, it's not on the slide or only in the bubble over there, it also means that the required capital is minimal when you use risk-free rates. So, again, a bold assumption, like a bold statement, and let's go through the proof. This is actually like the steps that we will take in the proof. So we look at the current estimate and its risk. We look at the margin over current estimate in pretty much detail, and then the required capital will be just a corollary, like in the end, quickly done. So, let's recall how like a stylized, simplified ICS balance sheet looks like. So we have the assets at market value, we have the liabilities, the other green box there in the middle, consisting of the current estimate and the MOCI, together the technical provisions for the liabilities, and essentially the rest is aggregated retained earnings and capital that make up the available capital of the company. And we take that balance sheet and we do two types of risk assessment. One is just with regard to running off the liabilities. We do a risk assessment that leads them into the small blue box there, the runoff cost of holding capital. But we also determine the required capital, and in order to do that, we have to take the full liabilities and the full assets that we are really invested to into account. Now, let's consider briefly and in a nutshell what happens, like where is the difference when we discount with risk-free and with asset spread. So discounting with an asset spread, of course, if discount rates are higher, it reduces the current estimate. We all know that, and I think some of us who were there here yesterday have seen like that can be quite significant for some companies. I think you mentioned three or four in that context. Good. What happens to the MOCI? So the MOCI increases. Why does it increase? Well, there is an additional risk that wasn't there before, and that is that the asset portfolio that I'm investing to has yields cash flows that are different from the expected cash flows because Remember, we have to match the expected cash flows of the default prone asset. So they can be lower if we don't observe any defaults, less than expected, or they can be, the cash flows can be higher if we don't observe that many defaults, or they can be lower if we observe a couple of defaults more than we have expected. So that's clear. So there is an additional risk, and of course, that risk needs to be catered for, because we can't just push that risk on to the policyholder in its entirety. The capital provider has to pay for it. And this is how it comes in, why the market price of default risk becomes important. Now, that increases how much is the question. We will come to that in a second. And the next question is, of course, what happens to the required capital? On the one hand side, it decreases because matching up the assets with the liability cash flows, we don't encounter any spread risk of those matching assets because liabilities move in sync. So it decreases the required capital. However, since the MOCI increases, and the MOCI needs to be taken into account when calculating the required capital, it increases. So it's unclear where it moves, and I will show you that it goes up in the end if you take default-prone assets to replicate your liabilities. All right, so that was an overview, but let's go a little bit deeper into this question, and I've prepared an extra slide for it. Matching future expected cash flows for liability. So the top line is just what I talked about, risk-free. So you start with the middle part, not from right to left like in the presentation of Peter, but we start in the middle in my presentation. We start with the future cash flows of the insurance liabilities. You take them, you calculate the expected cash flows, and then you set up your risk-free portfolio that it exactly matches those cash flows. The remaining risk is that the liability cash flows deviate from the expectation, and that needs to be catered for in the risk in the margin over current estimate. If we take the lower part of the picture, we also start in the middle, the future cash flows, but we match the future expected cash flows that are prone to default risk. We match them up, and then the MOCI has to cater for both. Wonderful. So let's go one step further, and the one step is like just an aside here. Insurance risk and default risk, and I think it was mentioned somehow before, have very different properties. Insurance risk is mainly, and I say mainly because it's not really true, idiosyncratic. It's not too fat-tailed. It's well-diversified if it's well-managed, for example, by an internal model. And it's non-cyclical in no way. Default risk is mainly systematic. We have credit crisis. We have a little bit of an idiosyncratic part in it, but the main part is systematic. It is fat-tailed always. And believe me, I've worked long enough for a reinsurer that I know what I'm talking about. Default risk is fat-tailed. It is hardly diversifying. If it hits you, it hits everybody. The risk tolerance is the same that we are applying, 1 in 200 years, but the exact price for that risk to cover up for that risk tolerance, that is what I will discuss in the sequence of the talk. However, there is another, not a topic now, but a topic for the standard setters and the regulators and the supervisors in the room that they need to take care of. The risk tolerance in insurance risk to systemic risk is arbitrarily large because essentially insurance risk is not systemic. It can't be. It, given the characteristic above, it is not. Default risk is different. It can be systemic, and I think we have examples enough in the room where this has happened. So that needs to be taken into account. By the way, the proper cost allocation, like also for the risk tolerance of the policyholder, that is very, very important in order to be able to, at the end of the day, internalize external costs that would be otherwise associated with it. So it's an important thing also from a macroprudential point of view. Okay, so let's go a little bit into the MOCI and let's find out how to take this additional default risk into account. So I've said that before, MOCI is the balance sheet reserves as part of the liabilities that is there to cater for the cost of indemnifying investors to provide this risk-bearing capital over the lifetime of the liabilities to make the runoff acceptable to the policyholder. So how much capital is really needed in order to make it acceptable? And what is really needed is, of course, in each and every runoff year, we have to deal with the 1 in 200 year event. So the 99% is the required capital for that. So now we are sitting in each and every runoff year, and we are trying to determine the cost of providing or of from the point of view of the insurance company, the cost of holding that capital or the cost of providing, the price for providing that capital from the investor side of view. And for insurance risk, we have already seen that the current assumption or the longest standing assumption in the ICS is 500 basis points above risk-free. And I think we are testing another option now with a little bit of risk-free part, again, in the 500 basis points within as part of the 500 basis points. For the default risk, we have to determine the market price of the default risk. And that's essentially the market price of the instrument that hedges that risk. So let's try to find out whether we can find a traded instrument that is hedging that risk. And I will, first of all, say, like, forget about the insurance risk. We deal with the aggregation to insurance risk later. Just look at a company that has no insurance risk whatsoever and just has this expected default risk on their balance sheet. So here is a crash course in portfolio credit default swap pricing. Because a portfolio credit default swap on that asset book that is matching up the liabilities is exactly the instrument that we are talking about. And its price is what the investor will ask for in order to take on that risk. So, on the, hold on, left-hand side, we have the portfolio. And up there is the value of the portfolio. And what the investor covers is the 1 in 200 year loss of the portfolio. So I write it down like the reinsurance treaty for those that are familiar with this kind of stuff. So there is a retention that is up to the 1 in 200 year loss. That is what the equity provider carries because that's the equity that he has in the company. And all the wonderful default losses that occur will be counted against that. And every excess loss then goes to the policyholder, to the white part here. Now, this is the cover. How is the price distributed between the owner of the equity tranche, how this is called in PCDS language, and the owner of the excess tranche? And that's very simple. And you have to believe me or you have to ask your quant, between 90% and 100% of the price to cover the whole portfolio go to the equity tranche. Why is that so? Well, the 1 in 200 year loss is huge. And most of it is really like concentrated there. Most of the defaults are concentrated there. For a high quality portfolio, for a lower quality portfolio, you get some weight into the upper bit, and you would hand over some risk to the policyholder. So while this is difficult, and you need a quant in order to do that, the total price to get the cover, that's an easy one. The total price is just the spread, the annual spread on that asset portfolio. Why is that so? Now, very simple, that's finance 101. If you ask me to take on that risk, I ask you to provide the assets to me. I will double them up until I have a risk-free position, and I ask for a little extra margin for my and fees, transaction fees. Then the next thing that I do when I've received that is I sell the bond portfolio. I buy a risk-free portfolio that has exactly those cash flows that I need in order to pay you off. I pay the transaction fee, I cash in the margin, off I go, I write the profit, and I never, ever deal with that again. So this is easy, that the spread is the price for the one-year cover. 90%, now listen, 90% of the spread that we earn is needed in order to satisfy the capital provider. And maximum of 10% can go to the policyholder. This is what spoils the equation. Now, before I go one step further, I will deal with the aggregation to insurance risk. Now, this was for a funny company that hasn't got any insurance risk whatsoever. And to be honest, here it becomes really technical, and it took me about half a year to find out how to do that. For those that are mathematically inclined, we do a risk change. We do a change of the risk measure from the physical measure to the risk neutral measure, but just for the part of the default risk that is inclined. For the other risk, we stay on the risk on the physical measure. So, in layman's terms, you can express it like the investor takes the loss that comes from the insurance side first. And then there's a little bit of capital left in the company. If the insurance loss is large, there's little capital left in the company. If the insurance risk is lower than the expected, there's even more capital left in the company. And essentially, it's that amount of capital that is at risk for the investor. So it's a contingent amount of capital. And we have to combine those contingent PCDSs, prices, for the different cases that we have to sum up. So that's technically how it's done. So when you do all that, you find that the price isn't greatly reduced if you mix in insurance risk. That is something that I found hard to believe in the beginning, and I find less hard to believe after having done all the calculations in various examples. So essentially, cost doesn't diversify. So that is what is happening. And in all the examples that I calculated, and some of them were a little bit prone to calculation errors, not more than 85% of the asset spread needs to be provided to the investor. Good. Now comes, there's always a point when the taxman enters, and that's usually the point in time when it becomes less funny. And as so here, MOCI is the pre-tax balance sheet items. In order to provide the minimum 85% of the spread to the investor, You have to earn it and pass it through your P&L. There's no way around it. Dividends get taxed before they are paid out. So assuming a corporate tax rate of 25%, you have to gross it up, which brings you in the order of magnitude of 110 to 133%. And then it's done. Because that means, and that is per year, and then you aggregate it over all the years. So instead of having the spread, the annual spread, in each and every run of year, you get the total value difference between the credit prone portfolio and the risk-free portfolio. So the mochi has to be, the amount that has to be added to the mochi is 110% at least of the difference between the risk-free matching asset portfolio and the default-prone asset portfolio. So essentially everything that we have saved by discounting the liabilities in a different manner has to be added and a little bit more into the mochi. This is spoiling the equation. And that is a fact.